Hello everybody, my name is Florin Vazbari and I'm a professor at London Business School, where I teach private equity to our MBA students as well as senior executives. I'm also the academic director of the Private Equity Institute. Together with my colleague Ellie Talmor, I have co-authored the private equity textbook entitled Private Capital, which is used by market participants as well as students in our classes. The book covers many aspects of private equity investing. In particular, it has a chapter on environmental, social, and governance issues that are faced by private equity fund managers and their investors. Impact investing and sustainability have become a big topic these days, as many private equity funds are incorporating ESG goals into their strategies. A wealth of hard data corroborates this trend. A recent Bain & Company report found that close to 2,000 fund managers, including many private equity firms, signed up to the United Nations-supported Principles for Responsible Investments last year in 2018. That is a significant jump compared with only 1,200 managers back in 2013. This move is supported by investors, with a recent survey from Schroders showing that today 80% of investors are putting more emphasis on sustainability than 5 years ago. This pressure from investors is pushing fund managers to pay greater attention to environmental and social issues. However, it is important to note that data suggests that ESG and impact investing can actually generate strong financial returns. The assumption that good environmental, social, and governance performance lowers profits is actually wrong. Many research studies have documented a strong positive correlation between ESG performance and financial returns. Research from Bain & Company, for instance, shows that deals which score very high on ESG factors generate significantly higher multiples on invested capital compared with low-scoring deals. You will now hear more about impact investing in private equity from our panelists at the Private Equity Symposium: Diana Noble, Michelle Giddens, and Josh Lerner. Diana Noble is the founder of Kirkos Partners, an advisor to leaders of private equity firms, and previously she was the CEO of CDC, the UK's development finance institution. Michelle Giddens co-founded Bridges Fund Management back in 2002, and she now focuses on strategy, investor relations, and social impact assessment. Professor Josh Lerner is the head of the Entrepreneurial Management Unit at Harvard Business School. He has worked for many years on issues concerning technological innovation and public policy at the Brookings Institution.
It's nice to sit on a panel here in the UK and actually be able to big up the UK, particularly at the moment. But actually, 1948, CDC can be attributed with being the very first impact investor. So back in 1948, it was the UK government who said, let's put a pool of capital together that does have a dual purpose, that is there for financial return and for impact. Didn't use those words at that time. It was described as do good without losing money. And it was for a very specific purpose at the time, which was that, you know, UK had a, you know, had the colonies and they were going to become independent, and the UK felt it should invest in the private sectors to put them on a better footing before independence. So that's why it started. Now, obviously, it's morphed a lot since then and grown. But if you look at CDC and ask the question, has that dual purpose been successful? Because that's one of the questions, you know, we all have for impact investing today, is what's it going to look like in 10, 20 years' time? On the impact side, you go around Africa and you see cement factories, plantations, financial institutions that simply wouldn't exist without CDC. It was the start of the huge Kenya tea industry, for example. And then on the financial side, between 1948 and 2014, the UK government and the UK taxpayer drip-fed £144 million into CDC, which by 2014 had become a balance sheet of £3.4 billion. So financially and from an impact point of view, it's had its ups and downs over the decades, which we can talk about, but there's a lot to learn from this industry that we now call DFIs, because there are now many institutions that have followed CDC from all the different countries, and then the IFC, which is the development finance arm, effectively, of the World Bank, modelled itself in the early days on CDC as well. So there's many, many people doing this. So, you know, it's easy to say the impact investing space were pioneering, but actually they are following the footsteps of the development finance institutions.
What else should we put in? If we're thinking about intellectual antecedents, clearly the DFIs have been enormously important. Would you see other actors as being ones that you'd sort of put in the landscape there as well?
Yeah, I was just thinking about where I would start, because there's no doubt that this is not something that's come from nowhere at all. I know that for a fact because we've been doing it for 17 years, so that's one fact that I know. But then if you think about it, actually the idea of how you think about the ethics of your money has been around for millennia, in fact. And we've seen many religions over time think a lot about how they feel about lending, for example, if you think about the Islamic religion or the Jewish religion has various also moral codes in relation to how you think about investments. You go back to the end of the 19th century, and I think we had a little bit of a similar moment. Mid to end of the 19th century, we had the Industrial Revolution. And we had this kind of sense of panic of kind of this equality, this inequality is getting extreme. What are we going to do about it? And you saw the rise of the cooperative movement. I think you get to points in economic cycles where there are elements of the system that don't feel very sustainable. And it feels to me as if we are at another one of those points. If you think about what Mark Carney said, if you haven't seen his speech on inclusive capitalism, I recommend it to you. And he says that to have an inclusive form of capitalism, we need three key things. So we need, he says, relative equality of outcomes. So there's so much research that shows when you have very high levels of inequality, it is associated with instability, lack of well-being, and difficulty. So he says relative equality of outcomes. He says equality of opportunity, and he says fairness between generations. And if you look at what we've got now, you hear so much about the younger generation saying, you know, what are you guys leaving us? You're leaving us a planet which is in a catastrophic crisis. We can't buy houses. Incomes are not going up for a whole range of even the middle class. And so we've got this sense of a lack of fairness between populations. We've got, although greater equality, thanks to organisations in some part, like CDC, we have much greater equality, as everybody knows, increasing equality between countries, as we've had so many people taken out of poverty in the last 15 years. But we have enormous increases in inequality in individual countries, higher than we've ever seen. And then we also, in this country, we see, you know, real problems with a lack of social mobility. So I think the first thing to say is that I think we're at a moment of time where I'm not surprised that this idea that we need to kind of reform markets and we need a different way of doing business and a different way of investing is suddenly really taking off. The other part of the history is, you know, what did it look like in 2002 when I and some co-founders founded Bridges? Well, we had the history of boycotting things. So we had don't invest in South Africa. We had exclude guns and, you know, exclude gambling, exclude bad things, those kind of ethical funds that were mostly about investing in public markets. And then we had the rise of microfinance, where suddenly people thought, well, it's unbelievable. You can do this stuff really helping poor people, and you can actually make money as well. And those two things were the germs, I think, of what was turned into impact investing. Our insight was to say, well, if we're trying to make our money matter, why are we focusing on the public markets? Because actually the place in terms of investing where you can make your money matter very directly because you have such control and such a close relationship with companies is in private markets. It's in private equity. It's in what you're going to talk about later, private infrastructure. And so what's really welcome is we've seen the rise of responsible investing. The signatories of the PRI, we're looking at it, it's 90 trillion of assets under management globally have at least signed the principles of responsible investing. But then we've seen the private equity industry enter all of this in the last 10 years, really, I suppose. And then the rise of impact investing is all part of that same, I think, reaction to the question, how does capitalism better serve society?
I mean, I guess, you know, this discussion sort of prompts me as a sort of question, which is saying, even if we accept that this is desirable, right, that there are big social problems out there, and that in some sense, the huge pools of private capital have something to do with addressing them.
Yeah.
There's still really the question of, is the way the industry is organized make sense? And I guess I was sort of struck by, we did a workshop in one of these academic practitioner things that we do at the business school a few months ago, where we brought in, you know, a number of the self-styled impact investors. And, you know, what was striking is you had everyone carrying this label, having this sign saying, we're impact investors. Mm-hmm. Yet when you looked at the groups, they were enormously different from each other. You know, you had some people who were classic Silicon Valley venture people saying, well, we're doing clean tech investing, but otherwise we're purely commercial. You had some people who were doing regional economic development strategy, was really concessionary kind of money. You had the big boys with their double bottom line kind of things, and they were all sort of under the same label. So how do you think about where the industry is at today? Because it does seem there's a bunch of stuff all mixed up under this label in a way that seems to be challenging to really for an outsider to really understand.
Shall I have a first go?
Yeah, why don't you take a shot?
I mean, I think it is confusing, but I think it's good. Because what that essentially means, that sort of confusion and all those different players coming in using this label in different ways, it just shows that there's a lot up now, whereas there were a few, Bridges and a few other sort of pioneers that felt, I mean, we really felt we were whistling in the wind. We were out there going, make an impact and make returns, and everybody else was going, la, 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 wrong, because you need to either make money or you need to give away money. Polar. Those are the two things you can do. And what the last 15 years has shown is a rainbow, if you like. We call it a spectrum of capital. If people haven't seen it, you can look online. There's this diagram called the spectrum of capital, or continuum of capital, that shows what has developed in between those two polarities of make as much money as you can as long as it's legal, hopefully legal, and then give away a lot and do it with your heart and don't worry about ever getting it back and don't really worry about whether it makes an impact. And what we've started to see is a creation of a terminology, but it's a confusing terminology in between the two. And so what Bridges decided to try to contribute to that through the non-profit field-building arm that we have called Bridges Insights was to create something called the Impact Management Project, which tries to bring down to earth, it maps out what are the actions that investors can decide to take if they cross a very important Rubicon. That Rubicon is to say, it's not just that impact investors make an impact, all investors make an impact. That's just a fact. All investments are making an impact on society and on the environment. The question is just, if you manage those investments and you have control over them, do you think it's your responsibility to manage that, or do you not? And if you do, then you're on this spectrum, and you're going to decide in which ways you can manage it. And we go through an A and a B and a C, and we say, you know, for some, all they can do is invest in things that A, avoid harm. So that's back to the kinds of exclusions, boycotts, those sorts of things. But invest in things that can avoid harm. If you can go further, then you invest in things that benefit all stakeholders rather than simply looking to benefit the shareholders. So that's the B. And then if you can go further, then you go into the C, and the C is investing in businesses or infrastructure or properties that actually contribute to the solutions to challenges. So we've developed this very, very simple ABC. And then if you look on the Impact Management Project, it's impactmanagementproject.org, it's all public sourced, then you can also see which actions investors can take. Some investors, all they can do is to signal that they care about impact in the way that they choose their stock market companies, but they can't actually change those companies or what they do, all the way down to those investors that can be very hands-on, or those investors who can even take a lower rate of return, I know we'll come to that, in order to achieve impact. So that spectrum is now mapped out. But I personally think that just the fact that they're all showing up and they all want to talk about impact is the first sign of momentum, and all the sorting and the impact integrity and all the measurement that needs to come will come.
Yeah, I'm afraid I find it difficult to disagree with that. Mm. We are at a stage of sort of explosion and proliferation. And, you know, we've seen this in lots of different types of investing industries before. So, you know, when in 1999, you know, the internet explosion, you know, and lots of things didn't happen or happened later, but really, really good things came out of that. we were talking about 5 to 10 years ago about impact investing being this sort of independent asset class. Mm. And that would have been very constraining. I think it's very exciting to see now that it is just viewed as a way of investing in every single asset class that exists today. And that is leading to a lot of sort of unlocking of creative strategies and the, you know, the type of event that you had, Josh. But of course, you know, proliferation and explosion means confusion, you know, where language hasn't quite caught up, classifications haven't quite caught up, you know, how to measure, we'll talk about that, I'm sure, hasn't caught up. And we also don't really know what works and what doesn't work, but fantastic that we're at the experimentation stage because, you know, I guess we're all here and interested because we all know the global problems that we're facing are enormous and intractable. And probably, again, 20 years ago, we would have, you know, as a commercial investing world, we would have said, oh, aid can sort that out. That's not our problem. So the fact that it is now a collective problem and commercial capital and the best investment skills are all thinking about this, it's needed.
We do need to be a little bit careful. So we're both wearing our UN SDG pins, and you'll all be aware of the Sustainable Development Goals created in 2015 by the UN, and we've got till 2030 to achieve them, and they have been an amazing galvanising force in impact investing, but they're also phenomenally beautiful, designed by Richard Curtis and his team, and we are starting to see asset managers slap these SDGs all over every presentation. It's kind of extraordinary. Just 2 years ago, nobody even knew what they were, and now they are emerging. And so, you know, as we see the proliferation, there is also a need to make sure that we hold entrants accountable, that they actually are hopefully making some investments that wouldn't have happened otherwise. I think that's one question, because what we're seeing a lot of at the moment with mainstream entrants is labelling investments that they would have made anyway, but labelling them as impact investing. And I think it's a great start, but we just need to be aware of you know, what actually has changed on the planet as a result, and labels alone, of course, are not enough.
So in a way, there does seem to be some creative efforts to say, look, we're really woke and SDG compliant. We're things have not always changed so much, which sort of brings us to the question of saying, is there really a trade-off here? You know, I was talking to one general partner where they had some traditional funds and the impact fund, and he was trying to tell some story where we're going to be doing all these high impact investments and we're going to get as good returns as we're going to getting it from our main fund. And, you know, I was being a little grumpy or something like that, so I impolitely asked the question of, well, then why don't you do all the investments out of the main fund in these high impact things as well. And he was like, I think I've got to go to another meeting now. but, you know, so is there really a trade-off here between, you know, the financial and social returns, or do we live in a world like I was being described where this is just additive and everything is really wonderful as a result? I mean, you must have dealt with this issue.
Yeah, so both of us have lived this question for quite a long time. So my view on this is there are two things to keep in mind here. The two rules I've got when I try and describe this to people. One is strategy and execution drive returns. Okay, so what you decide to do and all the different elements of that and how you execute it. So impact is just the sort of the wrapper around that. So whatever you actually choose your strategy to be and how you execute it will matter miles more than impact. So you have to look through the impact label to say, what is this team actually, you know, planning to do? And that is what will drive it, not per se the fact that it's impact or not. And the other thing is, with these two objectives, if you're running a fund that has two objectives, there isn't a fixed relationship between the two of them. And I spent a lot of time with my shareholder at DFID explaining this, because they tend to feel that if they saw the financial returns going down in the fund, by definition, impact would go up. It's like a seesaw, they felt. And vice versa, that if you were getting high financial returns, your impact must be lower. Okay, this is not true. Absolutely not true. So, you know, some of the best investments in CDC's portfolio, particularly at the time of the mobile telephony across Africa, fantastic investments, unbelievably impactful. And, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, you know, if you have a failed investment financially, the chances are you won't have any impact, or actually might have created negative impact as well. So that relationship is not a fixed one. So that's at the sort of the strategy of the firm level. If you look at what is happening in the industry now, it seems to me to be debated that there's beginning to be a bifurcation now between largely big private equity firms, you know, the KKRs, the TPGs, etc., who are deliberately pursuing a responsible investing strategy, but quite close to their heartland. So it's, you know, healthcare, education, but done in a responsible way, where they're not really pushing the envelope of risk much. And therefore, I think they can justifiably say we're very mindful about creating more impact, but from a strategic point of view, we're not taking more risk that will drive down returns. And then the other end of the market are people who are much more specifically focusing risky strategies. Not necessarily more impactful, just riskier. And riskier strategies, so if you invest in, you know, harder geographies, startups, inexperienced management teams, you're going to get lower returns. But there is much more honesty, I think, with LPs or sources of capital that for these risky strategies, because the risk of failure, you might get some successes, but the risk of failure is so much greater that your net returns are going to be much lower, and the capital accepts that. So that's, I think, the way the market is going. In the middle, it's much messier and more chaotic and difficult to describe.
How do you guys grapple with an investment committee at Bridges? I mean, in the sense you must see a lot of stuff which falls somewhere along this, and how do you guys think through those issues?
Yeah, but so for us, so I'm now going to focus on the C, which I think of as an impact investor. So an investor that's looking to take an investment and contribute to a solution, because that's what we mostly are doing. We do Bs as well, but mostly Cs. And the way we look at life, and the way I think kind of true impact investor should look at life, is look first for the big challenges. So we, for example, took the SDGs. There are 169 underlying targets under the 17 SDGs. We narrowed it into 39 that we thought were very relevant in the UK market, talking about our UK funds, and then were also investable. So we go looking for challenges, and then we think about what might be an investable solution. And so where that's led us as a firm, we didn't know this at the beginning, but where it's led us as a firm, Josh, is that we've got multiple private fund strategies. Because sometimes the way in, let's say that we're worried about obesity. So sometimes the way in is to say, well, what about school lunches? We'll invest in what we think is the best high-quality school lunch company. In fact, we bought two and put them together and we created Impact Foods. And we do that through our growth capital funds. And they are completely normal from a risk-adjusted return funds. They're in the private equity category. And, you know, the better and the healthier the meals are, the more schools buy them. And it's a complete kind of correlation between returns and impact. And so we would do that from a fund where we know that our investors are looking for market rate returns plus impact. But then there's other things we can do over in another part of the Bridges world, which would be in a different investment committee, by the way, where we use a social impact bond as a tool. And so through a social impact bond, we pay the working capital for a nonprofit to work with individuals in the Northeast that are developing diabetes because of their weight and their lifestyle. And that nonprofit is able to turn back the clock so they don't develop diabetes. That saves a huge amount of money to the NHS, and therefore the NHS is prepared to pay against outcomes. And that's where the returns come for the investment. That's pretty pioneering. That is looking for a different level of financial return from the growth funds. We also have real estate funds, and we have also, I think, very much to the point, where we see a tension between the growth and the value of the company and the growth in its impact, we don't invest in it through our growth capital funds. It would go over to our Evergreen fund, and in Evergreen, we can hold long businesses that are very impact orientated, and they are profitable and they are growing, but it wouldn't be right to push them for the 4 or 5 times multiple in 3 to 5 years and then flip them on to someone. They actually want us to own them
for the long term. So we created Bridges Evergreen Holdings, and that's exactly what it does. So I think the fact that we start with the impact and then we work back to see, you know, what kind of financial product could we have to invest into that, to solving that challenge, has resulted in this multi-fund strategy that we never knew we were going to have at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But I think it makes perfect sense because we need different pools of investors who are happy with different levels of risk-adjusted return. The vast majority, it's market return, but there are those that will do the very pioneering stuff. And last thing I was going to say is if you just, I mean, the question is sort of a non-question in that there are different problems that can be solved at different levels of financial return. And it isn't the case that you can solve all the problems of the world and you can make, you know, TPG-style returns. You know, there are some things that you cannot do with that kind of money. So I think it's 64% of the impact, self-declared impact investing industry. 64% is looking for market returns. And Cambridge Associates' review of it shows that they are making pretty much market returns. And then the remainder are trading off risk or return in order to achieve perhaps some of the more difficult impacts.
But the key thing I think that's changed is there's realism, or much more realism in the market. Look, I'm a very big fan of Jacqueline Novogratz and what she did at Acumen. But in the early days of Acumen, when they were raising money for their first investing fund, they would go around and say, and I think most people in the room know what that strategy was, which was startups in the poorest countries in the world, not even in cities, in rural, selling to resource-poor people with entrepreneurs who'd never done it before, right? And in those early days, she would go around and say, I'm not looking for a market return, I'm looking for 5% return. And you just think that degree of precision, impossible when you're layering risk upon risk upon risk. So I do think we've all kind of grown up as an industry a bit more, and funds with specific strategies that are could be incredibly impactful but very risky are genuinely being channeled to the kinds of investors who that's okay with. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of segmentation are we seeing in the investor world, right? I mean, we've alluded a little bit to DFIs. You've talked a little bit about the British government being implicitly being an investor with these social impact bonds and so forth. How do you think about the landscape of who's willing to actually go out and write a check for one of these things?
To be clear, the UK government in a social impact bond environment is the payer of the outcomes contracts. Right. And for the taxpayer, that's great because you're paying just if the social outcomes are achieved rather than paying and the person continues to develop diabetes. So government is much more a payer. And part of what's happening in UK and US impact investing is around the question of, you know, the government is outsourcing a lot of very vulnerable services with very vulnerable people, and actually it's quite comforting to think there might be social enterprises providing or non-profits providing some of that and not just private companies, and there might be impact investors that are providing the finance for that. In terms, though, of where, for example, Bridges money comes from, about 85% of it is institutional pension fund money. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that way at the beginning. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, wherever we could twist someone's arm or cajole someone at a high level in an organisation to do what they knew they should not do, which was to invest with us. Mm-hmm. But now, we're obviously a bit more proven now. We're on our fourth vintage of a couple of funds and second of the more pioneering ones. And so it's also families. Mm-hmm. And if you look more broadly at the industry, families were very early adopters. Because families can, in fact, they can take that decision. Very few fiduciaries can say, I'm happy to take a lower return or take a higher risk. And because the whole industry was nascent, you could kind of argue that the whole industry was higher risk because it was, you know, new managers, new strategies. So families were quite early to adopt. But now I would say it's, you know, big institutional investors are driving it. You know, the reason that the big private equity firms, one of the reasons that they want to have these impact offerings, KKR, TPG, Partners Group, is because their LPs, their large pension fund and insurance LPs, are asking them to do it, is a great thing.
Right. Is there a geographic difference between, you know, for instance, US and Europe in terms of the LPs' interest in this area?
So I would say, for me, ESG, which is kind of responsible, the B category, as I described it, has become incredibly strong in Europe. And US was quite far behind that. And until only about 2 or 3 years ago, you know, I, for example, if I might get invited to the ESG conferences, but I would be told, you know, you're an impact investor, so you're not proper ESG because you're deciding to invest in things that are nice. We don't decide to invest in things that are nice. We invest, and then we try to take risk
out of the businesses we invested in using ESG. So I think that ESG strand was incredibly strong in the LP community, still is. It's a part of the questionnaires. If you've got particularly Dutch or Scandinavian funds, French LPs are all very, very strong on that. And the US has been behind. Mm-hmm. But the US has actually leapt forward, I think, with impact investing. And actually, I think, you know, maybe this is really too simplistic, but to some extent, the idea in America that it's a culturally a great fit to think you can make your money and do good too. And so that theme of the impact investor who says you can make just as much money and do the great things in the world has really taken off in the US very fast.
And I think to just round out the argument to talk about government money, because government money is also fueling the impact investment world through the DFIs, it's extraordinary how that money is changing. So back in 1990, investment in the private sector was 1% of the aid budget around the world. Since then, the aid budget has not kept up with inflation for lots of reasons that we know. But the investment in the private sector as a proportion of the aid budget is now 55%, and some people are saying it may overtake it in the next 10 years. And that's being driven by a bit of aid fatigue, frankly, but also because the countries who are recipients of aid are saying our biggest problem is jobs over the next decade and longer. Mm. Actually, we're doing reasonably well on education and health, and so people are getting into the jobs market, but the jobs aren't there for them. And so in terms of stability of countries, this is enormous. And so that's why the whole aid industry is saying, let's invest in the private sector to grow businesses, to create jobs in countries that really, really need them.
And it's also, you know, politically, it is in our best interests to do that, isn't it? Because in Africa, what proportion of the population is it that's under the age of 18? But it's like, is it the majority or something like that? Remember the statistics in Ethiopia when we were there on a CDC board trip? Just extraordinary, and how there's going to be enough jobs for that bulge that's coming through. And if there are not, then, you know, we're going to be with the immigration crisis that we have seen, for example, in Europe recently, is going to be dwarfed by what we're going to see in a generation's time if there are no jobs for those young individuals in Africa.
So it seems that one thing that's really essential for the mainstreaming of impact investing is measurement, right? And I think, you know, we know that even measuring financial returns is somewhat challenging in private markets. You know, we as academics have spent a lot of time writing about PMEs as an alternative to IRRs and, you know, all these kinds of issues along these lines. But it does seem that the measurement of impact is at very early going. It certainly seems that, for instance, one sees that at least when you look at the mainstream groups which have gotten into this area, many of them don't seem to have the kind of systematic and detailed reporting of impact that they would have for financial returns. What do you make of that fact that it does seem that this is so underdeveloped? And so, I mean, it may be that you guys are far advanced simply because it's been so core to your mission for so long, but what do you think about when you see where the state of impact measurement looks like today?
So, yeah, there are a lot of voices that say, until you can give me a number for what the impact is, I can't manage it. And that's for sure is an obstacle to more what I call the general impact management, which is where I'm talking about the whole spectrum and not just impact investing. And it is our view that in this century, impact will become a third core factor in any business or investment decision. People will ask, what's the return, financial? What's the risk of that return? And then what impact is it going to have on society? And if we're going to have those three, then we need much better metrics for measuring impact. But two things just to steady us a little bit, I suppose. One is I get asked, I mean, when people tell me, you know, it's nice that you do this impact thing, Michelle, but I can't do it because I need a really hard metric to compare in all my different investments on an impact from an impact perspective. Then I would say, well, you know, what's the number that tells you how risky a particular investment is? And we all know that actually to judge risk, you know, it takes a person to judge the risk
course, you can score if you're in a bank, and that's a proxy. You can have a risk rating done by a risk rating agency, and we know how brilliant those were just before the financial crisis. But they're all proxies. And yet nobody ever tells me, look, Michelle, I can count what return I'm going to get, but I can't count the risk, so I'm not going to incorporate the risk in my investment decision. And I suspect, in a way, impact is going to end up being a bit more like risk than it is like financial return. I'm not personally of the view that there will be a number that will tell you what the impact is, because it's much more complex than that. But if it's as important, then we just need to find those kind of proxies. And they are starting to come through. So there's something called the World Benchmarking Alliance that is going to start assessing large companies on their contribution to the Sustainable Development Goals. And they will do a huge amount of complex work, and they will give a simple rating. So there will be ratings that will be emerging here. For those that are distant from their investments, investing in quoted companies, you'll be able to see what the SDG rating is, for example. For those that are investing in private markets, you know, nobody ever tells me what risk one of the companies that I'm investing in is at. That is something that we judge. And the same is true in impact. And of course, we've got methodologies for that. But in private markets, you know, you can judge and you can measure the impact of your investments because it's so direct. Right now, there are a million different methodologies for it.
Right.
And I'm going to let you say the thing about accounting standards, because
I mean,
those took a long time to develop too.
I mean, it is challenging, right, in the sense that, I mean, you mentioned before that in a way you would like to measure things as compared to that but-for world where that investment didn't happen, right?
Mm.
So you can think about using jobs as a scorecard, right? If you're going and doing investing in old line manufacturing in the north of England, you know that the job impact is going to look, on an absolute basis, is going to look worse than investing in tech businesses in London, right?
Right.
But in a way, the comparison you really want to make is saying, what would have happened to that company in Yorkshire if it hadn't had this investment?
Yeah.
Maybe it would have, instead of losing 20% of its jobs, it would have shut down and lost all the jobs. So in a way, creating these things is clearly...
Yeah, but we can do that. So in the impact management framework, there are five key elements of impact. They're called the five fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly looking at what is the contribution you as an investor or your investment has made compared to how the world would have been. Another thing that you're getting at there is the question of the who. Who are you affecting and how underserved is that person? So create a job for someone who could have had 10 other jobs. That's one kind of job. Create a job for someone who is in, I don't know, is in rural Ethiopia or is in the northeast and has been unemployed. That is a different kind of who. So we are now starting to break down those five fundamentals of impact, and that's how we would report. We would score. We do now score each of our investments, scoring each of those five fundamentals of impact. Who are we affecting? With what? How much? What's the contribution? And what's the duration? And what's the risk? So the tools are emerging.
Mm-hmm.
But as we were just saying before we came in,
yeah,
it was complex to get generally accepted accounting principles too. And it took
centuries. It's a quote by Ronnie Cohen, who is obviously a partner of Michelle's, that I think he said it took 300 years to move from double entry bookkeeping to internationally accepted accounting standards. So perhaps we shouldn't be too depressed about where we are today on this.
Mm. How did you think about this issue at CDC in terms of...
So,
we never talked about that, did we?
No, not at all. When we first met, we had a good falling out over impact measurement. So it was interesting. When I got to CDC, and I think this is one of the pitfalls you can fall into, I looked at all the old investment recommendations, because one of the questions is, how do you choose your investments? That sort of drives everything, right? I looked at all the old investment recommendations, and they had a remarkable similarity. It was like a cookie-cutter paragraph of what this investment would achieve, right? And so it was absolutely clear that impact was never chosen, never used as a filter to say yes or no to things. So that was absolutely the first thing we had to do. And we put in something that was very much a proxy, very simple, but unbelievably usable, because the investment teams, who frankly in CDC, when you are investing in really hard countries, and pretty much everything you see when it comes to you is uninvestable, so you have to work incredibly hard to make it investable by structuring, by changing management team, by et cetera, adding a board.
your other measure, which is this going to be impactful enough and is it going to get through the IC or not, you want that to be easy. You want that to be something that you can decide in an hour almost, or else you're going to waste a hell of a lot of time. So that's what we spent a lot of time putting in place and getting acceptance for that amongst the teams. That was really the core of what we did in the first 5 years. Of course, then we said, what are we measuring? How much are we going to measure? Across what kind of frameworks, in what sectors, et cetera, et cetera. But really the core of demonstrating to ourselves that we were serious and demonstrating to our shareholder that, yes, we really cared about impact and we were prepared to say no to things that weren't impactful enough, this tool that we've had in place, transformative.
So I have one last question before we throw it open for 10 minutes or so of questions at the end, which is, I've been seeing a lot more people coming at office hours, not really MBAs, but people who've perhaps been out in the industry for a couple decades, you know, people who are executives at NGOs and other nonprofits, saying, we really want to get into this impact space. And either from a personal career perspective or just saying, we're doing all this interesting work and we can really leverage our grant-type money if we could get some sort of impact fund going. There's just a lot more interest in this, in trying to do this. And they're like, you wrote this private equity textbook. Where's the impact investing textbook to say, how do you go about the process of raising a fund and getting into the space? And I'm always like, beats me. I don't know. Good luck about it. But I'm hoping that you guys can give me some better sound bites so I can go back and give better advice during office hours here.
So I'm going to use this as a platform for my own personal little prejudice here. So private equity investing is about capital, strategy and deals, and people in your team. And almost exclusively, the impact investing world talks about strategy and deals and money. Doesn't really talk a lot about the teams that are doing the investing. And I think my advice is very much targeted at the people who have chosen hard strategies, not at the TPGs and the KKRs, because their teams can execute the strategies that they have put in place. But if you put in place a strategy that is a really hard one, let's say it's in a hard country, or it's in a sector that's not known, or not well developed, or it's a startups, you've got to match the skills in terms of caliber of people to the challenge of your strategy. I do think in the early days, people fell into the trap of saying, if we don't have to deliver very high returns, then we can hire people who care more about impact, who aren't necessarily very experienced investors. Absolutely not. The harder the strategy, the harder-nosed investors that you need in that team to make it work. And the other thing that sort of is related to that is I used to have a lot of debate with my shareholder about what would happen to the CDC team if they kept pushing us to lower return deals, okay? So taking on riskier and riskier strategies. Their debate to us was, we as your provider of capital don't mind if you deliver lower returns because we want more impact. That's fine, isn't it? We're happy. And my answer to them is no, not necessarily. Because riskier strategies result in a higher number of failures. Okay? And investment professionals really care about that for two reasons. One, they want good CVs. Okay? Every investment professional wants a high proportion of successes on their CVs. If you give them a strategy that they can't achieve that, they won't want to do it. Or at least the pool that you can fish in for people who are resilient enough to really try things that have a higher degree of failure than a success is a very small pool. And secondly, failures, and again, you know, providers of capital forget this. As an investor in private markets, if you're overseeing a failure, it doesn't just happen in one day. This can go on for 2 or 3 years where you're trying to save it and you're trying everything, and it's miserable work. Right. It's really hard, it's depressing, and you kind of lose your confidence as well. So putting a team in place to execute some of these really hard strategies, even though the impact that can emerge from them can be great, you have to be really careful and be honest about the kind of people that you need to execute these.
Hmm. I think I would go back to when I was sitting opposite Sir Ronald Cohen, who was one of the founders and at that time the chair of Apax Partners and had built that up
from when people said you can't do venture capital in this country in the 1970s through to, you know, the growth of the private equity industry. And we had a debate with each other. You know, we want to do an impact fund. Should we go to an Apax or a 3i or another manager and ask them to put a team on an impact strategy and raise an impact strategy with them, partner with them? And our decision was to say no, because we think that pursuit of purpose and a pursuit of impact will need to be in the DNA of everybody in the team and actually should be in the DNA of the organization itself. So we took the decision to create a new company, which became Bridges Fund Management, and to build that. And I think, you know, as we sit now today, kind of 15, 16, 17 years later, and we see a lot of large asset managers coming into impact investing, that question's kind of big in my mind as well. And so if I were in a job and I were thinking I want to do something in impact, I would be wondering to myself, is it a question of leaving the institution that I'm in and joining a specialist impact investor for me? Or is it a question of seeing whether I can be an entrepreneur in the institution that I'm in now and pull that into more impact, even if I'm saying let's start with ESG and then let's find our way, you know, through the spectrum to the harder and harder stuff? I think even after 17 years, I don't think we know the answer as to which is going to be most impactful. I know that Bridges does wake up every day with the DNA of wanting to make returns for investors and make a difference. But we are relatively small, so we're relatively big in impact investing, and we basically raised a bit over £1 billion. Whereas TPG came in with their Rise Fund and they raised £1.5 billion in their first fund. And so, you know, I would be wondering to yourself, you know, what's right for me? Do I go all in to an impact specialist, or do I haul the institution I'm in the direction of more impactful investing?
All right, so should we throw it open for a few questions? We've got around 10 minutes, so hopefully this has stimulated some thought. You're there.
So my question is about impact investing in emerging markets, and I just wanted to hear your opinions about how high a priority FX risk is in those scenarios, because you mentioned a lot of other risks, and I'm just wondering if something like that would kind of make you think twice about investing in a particular investment.
Yeah, so the question, I mean, FX risk, enormous, obviously, in a lot of these countries, incredibly volatile currencies, and from my perspective, they always seem to go the wrong way while I was there. So, but the question is, who's taking the risk, right? So one of the issues is that the DFIs, and particularly IFC, will only lend in dollars, not in local currency. So they're trying to find businesses to provide debt to, or infrastructure products to provide debt to, where they are taking no FX risk. And certly in some infrastructure projects in Africa, in power, the fact that the international lenders will only lend in dollars means that the government, who can only take revenues in local currency, are taking massive FX risk. And then you say to yourself, well, that's not very developmental, is it? So I think it's a great question, because it is huge risk, and I'm not sure that the international community has challenged itself enough to take enough of its risk itself in this area.
Yeah. So, I mean, in a way, you think about saying, like, you know, many of the more sophisticated global investors, like a CPPIB, who will have some sort of targets for exposure by geography. Mm-hmm. And for them, in some sense, you say, if they're targeted to put 5% of their money in India, the fact that it's private versus public and the private returns might be affected by changes in the rupee shouldn't in some sense matter, that they're making a long-term bet on India. And it shouldn't matter, but sometimes it does seem like it does matter anyway.
Yeah, I would just say, so in my period of time in impact investing, and I used to invest in emerging markets before setting up Bridges, we have seen a challenge. You know, in impact, you can get a lot more impact for your pound in investing in emerging markets. That's the reality. And so that's really attractive. And a lot of LPs that are interested in impact investing, they will tend to divide it into impact in my own country and impact in emerging markets. So that is very good in terms of LPs. However, it's still the reality that, you know, when Africa was in vogue to be investing in, what would be 6-7 years ago, you know, it was much easier for LPs to make the decision to put their money into something like a Leapfrog. I don't know if people know Leapfrog, that invests in healthcare businesses, but primarily microinsurance firms across emerging markets. In their most recent fundraising, though, they were doing it in an environment where India and Africa, you know, a lot of LPs just don't, they just close that window for a period of time. It's not that they keep that window open. A lot of LPs don't have a window open for emerging markets for the long term. Certainly most of the smaller ones, and it's usually the smaller ones that are investing in impact investing funds because they tend to be smaller. So you've got countervailing. You've got countervailing trends. But the good news is that the impact-driven investors know how much impact can be made in emerging markets, and that at least counterbalances a little bit of the currency risk and the other risks too.
Question here. Thank you very much for a very interesting panel. Thomas Lomonauskas, Sloan Fellow at LBS. So the question is about this, everyone is crowding into this space. And so JP Morgan recently announced that they are setting up a DFI inside of it. So is it from, just I wanted to comment, do you think it's just a, one of those blips in the everyone jumping in? Is it a kind of game changer that all the mainstream investment banks will also jump on it, not only private equity banks? And also, is it just a kind of dressing up with the fad and kind of put the brand in front of it, or is it a real thing?
It's a great question. We know that venture is, the private capital in general is prone to booms and busts, right? And you say the worst time to be doing venture investing was 1999, and you know the worst time to be investing in Brazil was 2012, when everyone else was doing it. Are we at peak bubble, as the question seems to imply, or is this more like venture in 1993, where the old guys were looking around saying, I don't like this, it's much bigger than it was before, but with the benefit of hindsight, it was still really tiny. How do you think about that?
Can I have a first go? I mean, the first thing is, before we get too excited, just look at the numbers. So even in the most optimistic numbers, the Global Impact Investing Network says there are about $500 billion invested in impact strategies of some kind. That compares to, if you just look at responsible investing, I've said that there are about $90 trillion invested in that. So the impact piece is still an absolutely minute part of the investing market. And although we can reel off now, you know, Goldman Sachs bought Imprint and KKR and JP Morgan, and actually UBS has a very active impact investing activity and has targets for it. So we can list off a lot of mainstream names we could not have listed off 3 or 4 years ago. But if you look at the amount of money they are putting into impact investing, it is still absolutely tiny. So I like to think about the adoption of new innovations and where we are in that curve. And I think we've gone through the kind of early adopters. We've gone through the chasm where the whole thing fails and isn't adopted. And we're into the early mainstream adopters. But we are not very far along there. I unquestionably think that this is the beginning of something and not a blip. But just like venture had, there will be blips. There already have been blips. You know, there's already been the scandal at TPG that has kind of raised a little bit of a questioning about all of this. There will be blips in all of this. But I would set it in the context of this wider question of, you know, is this century going to be one in which business and investment is expected to be responsible about the way that it affects society? I feel absolutely confident that that is going to be, it's going to be demanded by the millennials, it's going to be demanded by the younger generation, so it's not going to go away.
So we've been talking about the supply of capital. What about the other side in terms of demand? What do you see as the pool of investable assets? You know, where presumably what we mean by that is not a minus 20% IRR where we feel really good about ourselves, but the pool of investable assets where there's at least some hope of getting a somewhat reasonable return.
I mean, that's where strategy really matters. I mean, there's no. This is why, you know, having this at, you know, with three business schools around it, you know, there's nothing new in this world. It's about quality of strategy and the quality of execution. And some strategies will be very me-too strategies, and there's tons of capital already. So perfect example, you know, KKR's Africa Fund, you know, targeting big companies in Africa, huge fund. Artists of 5 years ago said, actually, there's too much capital chasing too few companies. Black Rhino, same thing, you know, Africa needs power, surely a lot of capital will help. Well, no, the issue is the pipeline of developing of assets, of projects, not availability of capital for investable assets. So if you get your strategy right, and there are so many different strategies here, by sector, by country, by, you know, by problem, etc. If you get your strategy right and the balance of capital and demand is right and you execute well, then, you know, you should do fine. But if you don't, you won't.
Yeah. I guess you through the lens of saying, are there problems in the world to solve?
Yes.
I think there we can be pretty yes. confident that there is a pretty big demand for that capital.
Yeah.
For me, it's not demand that I worry about. But you should be thinking about it across asset classes, because it's, you know, is it emerging market private equity that you're looking for, emerging markets infrastructure? Is it sustainable forestry, the future of food? You know, there's just so many themes that are impactful that need investing. Certainly for us, it would be more always we could do with more capital, because we could invest more capital if we had more capital. So I don't think we're yet at this stage. It depends also, though, what level of contribution you're going to make, because at the moment, I think that the big danger is that a big wave of capital, as I said before, is coming into impact investing, but that kind of impact investing, which essentially is adding a label to an investment that would have happened otherwise. And so my fear is this wave not washing into the harder places, not washing into some of the investments that Diana's talking about, where, you know, there's a big desire to have private sector capital coming alongside some of the DFIs into some of the difficult investments. And that's not a simple thing to do. So there's plenty of things to invest in, but will the really hard things get invested in?
Well, no shortage of great questions. I don't think we've exhausted this topic, that's for sure, but we have used up an hour. So I guess with this, we will bring a curtain over our panel, but not before I thank both of our celebrity keynote panelists for their contributions to the discussion. It was really interesting.
So
thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about private equity and impact investing, please visit our website for information about our programs at www.london.edu.